You have a line to Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He represents the 2nd Congressional District, including Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. And he's been on a town hall tour in recent days, fielding a lot of discussion around the impeachment inquiry and President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. And he co-chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus. What questions do you have for Congressman Pocan? How do you feel about the impeachment inquiry? Do you farm? What do you want to tell Capitol Hill lawmakers about the state of your family farm business? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, starting with the impeachment inquiry, we've seen a second whistleblower come forward regarding President Trump's call in July with the president of Ukraine. Do you consider what you see going on in the impeachment inquiry, do you consider these actions reason for an impeachment investigation?
Absolutely. And I think you're seeing the public is there within about 48 hours of getting some of the information about the call. About 80 additional members of Congress were there. This is absolutely concerning. You have in the situation with the phone call to the Ukrainian president, you have a motive, you have a crime, you have a confession, and you have evidence, which is a whole lot more than we had with the Mueller investigation. And very clearly, it's concerned because the president betrayed his oath of office by asking a foreign leader to essentially get dirt on a political opponent's family member. And the strange part is he's admitting it. And he gave us the notes from his transcript where very clearly this was a personal favor he was asking that was political. And because of that, they need to get a lot more information. And I think the Intelligence Committee is moving ahead very swiftly in getting that information.
U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, other Republicans are standing firm by the president. And Senator Johnson sees nothing wrong with the alleged phone call to the Chinese government to investigate the Biden family. Do voters deserve to know more about this concern and what Senator Johnson is saying?
Well, absolutely. First of all, I mean, people have to start putting their country before their political party, and we're not there yet when it comes to people like Senator Johnson, some of his comments. Clearly, he would never say if the president, as in the president's own words, shot someone on Fifth Avenue and he could get away with it. If it's a crime, it's a crime. And if the president violated his oath of office by doing that, we need to get to the bottom of that. So, again, I think the American public understands this way better than Republican politicians. I think as we continue to get more information, as you said, with a second whistleblower, I think this is something that Congress absolutely needs to deal with, especially since we know the Department of Justice has refused to indict any sitting president into the current attorney general. That means the only way you can do anything that's left, according to the Constitution, is to have Congress look at the impeachment process.
Well, as Congress does this, the House has a majority Democrats. If you vote to impeach the president, the Senate may not follow suit. Should Democrats still go through impeachment proceedings in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, this is one, I think often people also ask, is this good for the next election? And I've said very clearly, I took an oath to the Constitution, not to the Democratic Party, not to Nancy Pelosi. This is something we have to do because there very likely was something done improper by the president. And we have to make sure that any future president, Democrat or Republican, has to follow the law. And if we did nothing at all, I think you would really be setting a terrible precedent for the future. So, to me, it's pretty clear why we need to proceed. I think, again, for most people, I just did 6 town halls throughout the district. This was the number one subject. Very clear. People are very concerned. In Wisconsin, I think we like to think we live by the smell test. This doesn't pass the smell test. Most everything the president's saying and the Republicans trying to defend him. And, I think it's time for people to really realize that if the president broke the law, we have to, as a country, put the person aside. You have to deal with what happened. And that's our job as Congress to do that.
We're checking in with Democratic Representative Mark Pocan from the 2nd Congressional District. You can join in. What do you think of President Trump's move to restrict access to immigrants needing financial assistance? What do you make of the president's executive order on Friday and delaying unauthorized immigrants' health care coverage? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a look at immigration now. Next week, we see stricter standards for immigrants seeking citizenship in the U.S. taking effect. People who require housing assistance or food assistance face denial. What is your take on this layer in the immigration debate?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it's a 30,000-foot level. You know, we have to deal with immigration in a comprehensive way, which, unfortunately, the last several years we've not even gotten close to. Instead of talking about walls and separating families and taking away any potential for benefits for people who are in the United States, we should be really figuring out how to have comprehensive immigration reform. That means looking back at my very first session in Congress 4 sessions ago when there was a bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate with nearly 70 votes that had some extra protections at the borders, but also had a pathway to citizenship for aspiring Americans. We need to deal with it in that level. The problem is, again, this president, because he deals with it in such a political way, you know, it's build the wall and that's about it. We've had a hard time having that debate. So hopefully the public can kind of help recapture that we need to do something. Clearly, there's somewhere between 11 and 13 million people who are here undocumented. We have to be able to address it as an issue. And unfortunately, most of what we do these days is just talk about fighting over funding and where the president's going to steal funding to try to build a wall. And that's not having a debate about immigration.
Well, another point here on immigration, with the president's executive order Friday impacting people in the process of getting a green card, immigrants must prove they'll have health insurance or the ability to pay for medical costs on their own to become permanent residents of the U.S. Will that make health care more affordable in our country?
Well, I wish he had that attitude for people who are currently citizens, right, that we actually made sure everyone had health care. A lot of us have been working towards that for a long time. I mean, again, this is just the president throwing darts. He keeps missing not only the bullseye, but the entire board and probably the proper wall. And we just need to focus on what I think, again, the average person, as I'm going around doing these town halls, just wants us to deal with this in a comprehensive way. I mean, you can't.
Well, what is a comprehensive way?
Well, what I just mentioned to you 4 sessions ago, that's exactly what happened in the Senate. They passed a bill like that. We should use that as the foundation to at least start from. But it's not just throwing out decrees like the president likes to, or tweets. It's not just talking about a wall. It's understanding you already have a very substantial number of people who are here. We have to talk about that in part of any debate.
Representative Pocan, Republicans this year are calling some Democrats socialists. Some progressives like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders seem to be kind of embracing that language. Should Democrats be linking themselves up with socialists or socialism? What's your take on that?
You know, this is a decades-old Republican strategy. When we did Medicare, they called it socialist. You know, when we've done Social Security, I think it was decried as socialist. And yet these are some of the most, you know, popular programs we have out there. The Republicans just try to find boogeymen or boogie words. And in this case, socialist is the tag they're trying to put out there. They must have polled it somewhere and people don't like it. And yet it has nothing to do with the reality of what the current political discourse is. And again, throughout history, we've seen them throw this out and not be very effective. So this is just one more time. They're going back to an old playbook. The problem is we've read the playbook. We've seen the failed plays they've had. If that's their whole strategy going into next year, I don't think they're going to be especially effective.
We're talking with Congressman Mark Pocan. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Did you attend a recent town hall with Congressman Pocan? What questions do you have for him? What's top of mind? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this discussion in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Congressman Mark Pocan here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. He's been hosting a series of town hall meetings. Yesterday, he wrapped up two in Lafayette and Greene County. Did you go to them? Are you a farmer? What should Capitol Hill lawmakers know about low milk prices and exports, tariff policy, the situation on your farm? Do you live near Truax Field? What do you think about a proposal to add F-35 jets? Join in 800-642-1234. And Representative Pocan stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Chris is joining us from Port Wing. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, and thanks for the show. I'm interested in what the congressman thinks about the recent yesterday's decision by the Trump administration to abandon our Kurdish allies on the Syrian-Turkey border. This seems like a very bad precedent for building ally relationships, and it's going to lead to a massacre of people that have worked with us dealing with the Syrian issue.
Representative Pocan, what is the situation like for U.S. relations in Syria right now?
Yeah, you know, Chris, I think, hit the question right on the head, which is why he's doing this. It appears that all the president's advisors told him not to do this. He went ahead and did, as he does so well, tweeted out something about this that really runs counter, I think, to how U.S. policy has been in this area to the Kurds specifically. And then within hours appeared to have tweeted something maybe the opposite. So we're all left kind of shaking our heads, wondering what the president really meant after all. So just one more example of, I think, where this White House isn't running on all cylinders. And it really does put some real questions about what's going to happen to the safety of the Kurds in Syria should Turkey come in.
Well, last week, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue was in Madison at the World Dairy Expo. And when asked if our state dairy farms will survive, he said yes, but they may need to get bigger to do so. How should Congress support small family farms right now?
Yeah, well, I think the way it was taken by most people, and trust me, this came up repeatedly in both town halls yesterday, was he basically said small farms may be a thing of the past. You got to go big or go home. And that is not the representation of what agriculture is in Wisconsin. And yet we are losing so many family farms because of whether it be pressures on milk pricing, whether it be pressures on big agribusiness increasing costs, or most recently on several different trade deals where, again, the president's actions have put some real serious pressure on those farmers. But it just shows that if that's the administration's policy, throw that on top of, you know, tariff by tweet with China, you know, having still an issue with the Japanese trade agreement, still dealing with the NAFTA 2.0, and you can see why so many farmers are really concerned about their futures, and they want to know that the government really has their back.
Well, let's bring in Charlie now in Beaver Dam. Good morning, Charlie.
Oh, yes. I'd like to know about, I know there's Accenture, what, 4-year term limit, and then congressmen are, what, 2 years? But then if they get reelected, they can be in for 20, 30, 40 years. It was never designed, congressmen and senators, to be in as a lifetime politician. So what's your thoughts on term limits?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Representative Pocan, Charlie is concerned about term limits and what he's seeing among lawmakers staying in the job for decades.
Yeah, Charlie. So first of all, the U.S. Senate is 6 years. The state Senate here in Wisconsin is 4 years. And then the House of Representatives, where I serve, is 2 years, just like our state assembly. So I just want to make sure I put that out there. I've always looked at term limits as, you know, every election cycle essentially is the public's chance for a term limit. And in states where I've seen really tight term limits, like Michigan, for example, in the state legislature, what often happens is you see politicians basically enter this revolving field of then going into lobbying, and you give long-term lobbyists and often staff members the real keys to the car because they're the ones who continue to stay, and you just keep changing out the politicians, and that isn't necessarily the best for public policy needs. So I'm not sure if you simply get the answer by saying someone who's good has to leave at a certain time and someone who's bad can stay till a certain time. I think the election cycle is probably still our best way to deal with term limits.
We have Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan on the line, and he's been holding a series of town hall meetings in recent days in his district. That includes Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. You can join in. What's on your mind that you want congressional leaders to address in Washington? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's move on to prescription drugs now. Last month, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced wanting to give the federal government the ability to negotiate and cap prices on hundreds of prescription drugs. What concerns do you see with this plan?
Well, I think the bill has a really good foundation. We should be able to negotiate for drug prices. I mean, what Americans are paying right now is ridiculous compared to other countries. And I truly believe Al Capone, if he were around, would be blushing at the practices of the prescription drug industry. They have 1,500 lobbyists in Washington. That's three for every member of the House and Senate. I'm not sure who my three are, but clearly this is an industry that has way too much power, which is why we wind up paying so much for drugs. So the bill that Nancy Pelosi has put forward has us negotiating for drug prices. It's not just for people in Medicare, it's for everyone, so everyone would benefit from that. I think there's a really good foundation to the bill. The only criticism I would have is that the floor that they have to negotiate per year is 25 drugs, and I think that floor should be higher. I think since it is a good bill, let's be more aggressive and let's cover more drugs and let's save more people money on their prescription drugs.
You co-chair the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and I'm wondering how your caucus has been doing in recent times. Do you feel that you are of the same vision, and is your caucus growing?
We're about 40% of the Democrats in Congress, so it's a very large block of voters within our caucus, and some of the most active members. I think 11 of the 21 committee chairs are members of our caucus. So we've got, you know, people in a lot of really strategic places. They have a seat at the table where decisions are being made, and we've been having a lot of influence on the legislation that's been passed, whether it be H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which is the most comprehensive campaign finance, ethics, and elections reform bill, to many of the immigration bills coming forward, the minimum wage increase that we passed. We've really been at the center of many of those debates. So I've been really happy with a great group of members of our caucus.
You're active on a proposal to add the F-35 jets to Truax Field. Some people are concerned noise will be an issue around Madison, and this affects about 1,000 households. How are people in Wisconsin being heard on this issue?
Well, we've been, I think, active right now in a couple ways, because ultimately the military is going to make their decision, I think, regardless of what I and some others think. But the areas we're trying to help on is we did just get a 30-day extension for public comment based on a number of questions that have come up on frequency of flights, the amount of noise, and some other issues. We did finally get some answers from the Air Force, and at that point they did extend the clock 30 days. But I also have concerns over some of the language in these reports. I mean, sometimes government doesn't exactly make sense when they write things. For example, one line in the report was 1,000 households would be incompatible with residential use. What does that actually mean? And we've gotten a little more of an answer, but we're still trying to get to the bottom of what that means to real people in their homes and how they might be able to get some assistance for noise abatement if they do have F-35s come. And we're still kind of working through that process with people in the district.
So the process has been kind of slowed a little bit as you go through and hear more public comments on this?
They've extended, again, for 30 days public comment. I think one of my jobs is especially to put a little pressure on them, because in the report, about half of that 1,000 households, they're saying wouldn't be eligible for any assistance, and that doesn't make sense at all. So we're fighting for that. And also, I've asked for something I think that's real simple, and right now they're denying, and I'm continuing to pressure them to try to do, is I would like to have an F-35 and an F-16 both land at Truax so we can actually compare side-by-side the noise difference. Right now they don't want to do that because they don't want to set precedent for other sighting cases they'll have across the country. But I think it's the most reasonable thing. Trying to describe sound via report is not especially easy, but describing sound with sound would certainly be something that would make a lot of sense.
Well, many bases around the country would be so pleased to add a fleet of jets, to add to develop more of its base. Do you see there is pushback than should be expected here at Truax?
You know, in many ways, the debate isn't so much about the F-35, because I think that brings something like 55 or 65 jobs. It's the question of what happens to the 115th wing of the National Guard, because if they don't have something to work on, it could very likely go away. No matter what, through 2023, they're working on the F-16s, but the F-16s aren't going to be there after that point. So I think that's the real issue, because that's about $100 million of activity. You know, is there an alternative you could have that would keep the 115th? And I think those are just some of the issues that we're working through right now.
Well, Representative, thank you for joining us.
Oh, of course. Thanks so much, Kate. Appreciate it.
Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. Coming up, we learn about counterfeit books and how easy it is to sell fake or unauthorized copies of books at a lower price. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's a look at the publishing industry after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about book hacks and the problem of counterfeit books. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Photocopied books, plagiarized books. Publishers and authors are finding no genre is immune. Everything from Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express to medical handbooks have fake editions for purchase online. And so central to this conversation is the U.S.'s biggest bookseller, Amazon, and how it's responded to fake books. It said on its blog that it strictly prohibits the sale of counterfeit products and that it invests heavily in prevention. Have you accidentally bought a counterfeit book online? How did you realize it was fake? What happened? We're at 800-642-1234. David Streitfeld writes about technology for the New York Times, and he's been covering the complexities of the counterfeit market. David, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate.
So how widespread is this problem of counterfeit books on Amazon?
It seems pretty widespread from the complaints I get and from the people sending me the evidence that their books have been counterfeited or the books they're reading have been counterfeited. But we don't really know. The only people who know are Amazon, and they won't say.
And why won't they say? Why won't they release the information if they do have this?
Probably because it makes them look bad. Amazon will take down counterfeit books if you tell them about it, if you complain to them. But they do not proactively search for them. They don't really want to search for them. It interrupts their job of selling all sorts of books. So they kind of hope the problem will just go away on its own.
So when you go to purchase a book on Amazon, is there a way for the consumer to guarantee that the book you're buying is from the legitimate publisher?
Not really, because even if you buy directly from Amazon as opposed to from a third party, they can often, or they can sometimes at least, be fake. I've certainly bought fake books directly from Amazon. If you buy from a physical bookstore out in the real world, the chances of it being a counterfeit are much less because the books go through a stricter system and the counterfeits just don't happen that way. Online, however, there's nothing you can do to be completely sure you're not buying a counterfeit.
Well, when you say a stricter system, what does that system look like and why are there more safeguards going the traditional brick and mortar route?
It's complicated. On the brick and mortar route, it just always would be a major effort to counterfeit something. You'd have to do thousands of copies and then somehow get a relationship with a distributor who would buy the copies from you. If it was a famous book, someone would wonder why they were buying them from you rather than the real publisher. Online, you can just take a text, scan it in, send it in electronically to Amazon, and voila, you have counterfeit. Much, much simpler.
So when we think of counterfeit products, you know, you might think of purses or jewelry and maybe not books. So what makes a book counterfeit? You know, what makes it fake?
What makes it fake is if you, the person doing the counterfeiting, don't have the rights to do the book. And the only real way you, the customer, knows it's fake is if somehow you notice something, this counterfeit books with the title of the book or the author of the book misspelled. Generally, you notice because it's such a bad job and someone is just literally, in effect, Xerox the book that you were looking for. You look for a cheap copy. You naturally bought the one. You end up buying the one that is counterfeit because it generally is the cheapest. So you notice the quality of the book. Sometimes I found people say the books are actually a little bit changed. They're a little bit rewritten. And so if you know the book well, that could be a tip off too.
We're learning about counterfeit books sold on Amazon, and our guide is David Streitfeld. He writes about technology for the New York Times, and you can join in. Do you buy books from Amazon? What do you like about getting your books from Amazon? Are you concerned about the counterfeit book market? Join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So how does the counterfeit market affect the real publishers and authors here? Take us on the money trail.
Well, when you're buying a book, generally, if it is a book that someone produced, and if it's a book that a living person or a person who recently was living wrote, they get some of the money, and they have enough to feed their family and to write another book. If it's a counterfeit, all of the money that would go to the real author, the real publisher, goes to the counterfeiter, who is usually someone not in the United States. And they end up with all the money. The author of the real book, the publisher of the real book, says, wow, my book is not selling that much anymore. And their sales go down precipitously, often by, in examples I've seen, or sometimes by as much as 50%. And so the counterfeiter has very little investment in this, and they make most of the $20 or whatever the book sells for after Amazon's cut. And the author, as I say, doesn't make anything.
So where does copyright law come in? Where does public domain come in here?
Copyright law and public domain are really complicated. And in some cases, I wrote about George Orwell, the author of 1984. He's out of copyright in part of the world, so anybody can publish him. And then the books are imported and sold by Amazon in places like the United States, where he is in copyright. That is less counterfeit than just, I don't know, Amazon being a worldwide bookseller and letting the chips fall where they may. On the other hand, some Orwell books are counterfeited in the United States, and it can be hard, it was hard for me at least, to tell the two apart.
Do you think this will have a long-term impact on the publishing industry?
I think it could. It certainly is affecting the publishing industry now. We don't really know how big it is. And as I said, Amazon is not forthrightly telling us how big it is. It, you know, a really, really good counterfeit, a reader is not going to notice. It's going to be indistinguishable from the real book. And so you could approach a point where counterfeits are prevalent, and Amazon would still be making money, counterfeiters would be making money, but the real authors of the books would be making no money. That would be an unfortunate situation for all of them.
So what has Amazon's response been to this? Because they did blog about directly at you about your articles that you've been publishing and writing about in the complexities of counterfeit books.
Right. Amazon says it is doing the best it can, but it essentially has always operated as a flea market in terms of books, in terms of other products. You say you want to sell something, books or, you know, purses, and you go on Amazon and you start selling them. An Amazon representative does not come to your house and look over the books you're going to be selling and say, yep, these are the real thing, which effectively is the way it happened with Elise Books with bricks and mortar stores. So the person just starts selling books. Maybe they're real books. A lot of cases, they are real books. They wrote it themselves or whatever. In some cases, whatever percentage, they're not. And so Amazon tends to be more reactive than proactive. I wrote about George Orwell, who in 1984, the books are always being rewritten and faked. And so I thought it'd be interesting to look at him. And there were a lot of counterfeit George Orwell books on Amazon. So I wrote about it. Amazon said they would take care of it. I asked them about specific books. They took them down. And I was looking last night in preparation for this interview, and I found a whole bunch of fake counterfeit George Orwell books on Amazon.
Oh, they just pop right back up.
Yep. They're like, you know, they're like weeds. And Amazon says they really can't tell when the books are real and when they're not. But I don't know. The authors certainly wish they made more effort in telling. If I, a mere journalist out there, can tell, you would think someone at Amazon could tell too.
David Streitfeld, how does the global scope of our digital marketplace make this a much more complicated issue?
That's where copyright comes in. And as I said, with Orwell, he's out of copyright in part of the world. He's in copyright in part of the world, like the U.S. and his native England. And so the books can just be moved around. The legitimate books taken from India, in examples I've seen, and they're imported into America. Amazon stocks them at its warehouse and sells them. The publishers aren't doing anything wrong. The editions of the books, the ones I've seen, are not as good as the legitimate editions in America. They have some typos in them. They have misinformation on the covers of the book. They're not done with the greatest care. And yet, when you look online, they're probably going to be the cheapest because they don't have to pay the author anything. The printers were cheap. The quality is cheap. And so those are the copies people end up buying for their kids.
We're talking about the problem with counterfeit books with David Streitfeld. He writes about technology for the New York Times. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the counterfeit book problem and what it means for the publishing industry. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The New York Times' technology writer David Streitfeld has been reporting on this issue, and he found many of these counterfeit books, they have inconsistencies from the real book. They're printed and sold on Amazon by third-party sellers. Some are printed by Amazon's self-publishing division. So whose responsibility is it to prevent counterfeit books from being available on Amazon? Is there any other way for other booksellers to benefit from selling quote-unquote real books? Questions we're exploring with you at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And David Streitfeld stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Missy is joining us from Oak Creek. Hi, Missy.
Hello. I just wanted to say counterfeit is just a nice way of saying stolen stuff. Why aren't they held accountable as selling stolen goods, you know, like that serious
Yeah, Missy, you were breaking up just a little bit, but David, Missy's asking, you know, this is akin to selling stolen goods. Why aren't these sellers held responsible?
The sellers themselves, the people who do the counterfeiting, generally tend to be in other countries. And so they're hard legally to pursue. They're hard to prosecute. Each one can only counterfeit, can only steal so many books. And it's one of those problems that, you know, the most Amazon seems to do is kick them off and maybe, you know, keep their last check or whatever. As far as I know, there's has not been any prosecutions.
Yeah, is Amazon exposing itself to potential litigation here from authors or from publishers by not doing more to prevent counterfeit books?
In theory, it might be exposing itself to litigation. Remember, this is a very wealthy, it's one of the biggest corporations in the country, and it's got a lot of lawyers. And for one author to sue them and to prove something was going on, authors generally, even publishers, they don't have that much money. So there's not too much they can do. And there's not really that much information that they have. You know, they see a fake copy. Maybe it was just the only one. Maybe someone counterfeited one. Or maybe there were a lot more. The author never knows.
Is there a comparison here to be made to Facebook or other tech companies that have hired people to police their online products, to police social media? Could Amazon hire people to proactively monitor for counterfeit books?
It could, and it would, if it thought this was becoming a real problem and that people were not buying on Amazon because of it. And so, to some extent, if there is a public reaction, or if the public is even just interested in this, that will encourage Amazon to respond.
And then earlier this year, we saw Amazon launch something called Project Zero, which allows publishers to directly remove counterfeit listings from the site. How has that played out so far?
Amazon says it's played out well. It's hard to independently verify it. Part of the problem is if a legitimate publisher can say that something is counterfeit, it's easy for an illegitimate publisher to say that something legitimate is counterfeit too. And so, you know, the publishers have to register to prevent that from happening, and they have to be constantly scanning what Amazon is doing and making clear they're the real publisher. It's a lot of extra work for them, and they're, you know, they don't really feel it is their job to maintain Amazon's site when Amazon is making so much money from what it is doing.
And so if Amazon is following this kind of good in good faith effort by the sellers, that is more cost effective than policing its own site.
Right. It is, although, a kind of after the fact effort. Here is something that is being sold that shouldn't be sold. It's better than, I assume, not doing anything. But it doesn't really take care of the problem in the beginning, so the books are not sold at all.
You write about the Sanford Guide to Antimicrobial Therapy and this textbook issue, guidebook issue. Tell us this story about what happened there.
That was a scary one in that, you know, if you're reading a novel that is counterfeit, the money may have ended up in the wrong place. The author may not have been paid, but it didn't threaten anybody's life. With the Sanford Guide, it is a medical textbook, a small medical textbook used by doctors when you come in to the emergency room with certain kinds of ailments. It actually tells you what kind of drug and how much to give the patient. And the book was counterfeited, and counterfeited over several years. The publisher couldn't figure out what was going on. And some of the counterfeits were so bad, the pages where the drugs were, some of the pages, were smeared and were just blurry because it wasn't a great counterfeiting job. And that set up the situation that doctors wouldn't really know in the urgency of the moment what the drug dose was, or they would think a 5 was a 9 or whatever and give you the wrong dose. That's an ultimate example of how counterfeiting can really put people at risk.
So what was the upshot of that story? What happened to the publisher?
The publisher worked really long and hard to try to get Amazon interested in its problem. Amazon, according to the publisher, did not respond very well for quite a while. Eventually, when I called Amazon about the publisher, it responded more. The publisher ultimately took the step of trying to be more closely linked to Amazon, of having Amazon be the official distributor for its book, which is a way that counterfeiting can ultimately help Amazon. If Amazon does everything for your book, maybe it watches more closely how it's sold, and that could benefit you. So, and it can benefit Amazon. So Amazon says, you know, come to us. We'll take care of all your problems.
We're talking with David. Talking with David Streitfeld, who writes about technology for the New York Times. We're looking at counterfeit books, and you can join in. Have you ever accidentally bought a counterfeit book online? How did you realize you didn't have a legitimate copy? 800-642-1234. David, what can book counterfeiting tell us about online counterfeits in general and where this is going?
Well, there's certainly, books are just a very small part of the problem of counterfeiting online. Amazon has certainly acknowledged it. These are counterfeits coming, many of them from the third-party sellers that kind of exist on Amazon's site, not necessarily from Amazon itself. Government researchers did a study recently where they bought, I think, 47 products from sellers on various big name platforms, including Amazon, Walmart, and eBay. These were things like, I think, perfumes, other objects, not books. And 20 out of the 47, nearly half, were counterfeits. And that indicates the problem that Amazon and other online sellers will have to deal with.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
David Streitfeld writes about technology for the New York Times. His article about counterfeit books on Amazon is called Paging Big Brother in Amazon's Bookstore, Orwell Gets a Rewrite. And you can find a link to his article at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, thousands of Native American women and girls go missing each year, and now states want to do something about it, including Wisconsin. We look into how lawmakers are trying to stop violence against tribal women. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.